out to get it, Oladipo. Shot clock at 7. He's going to pull up and launch a long one.
Boom! 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 Baby!
He was several steps outside the arc, and he had the 6'11 Aldridge right in his mug.
It's time for another Sideline Guys podcast. I'm Pat Boylan alongside Jeremiah Johnson. First and foremost, you're not in a Minneapolis McDonald's, so I'm sure your scenery is much improved from last week.
Definitely good to have a little Monday tradition, I feel like, with the podcast, because we can look back on the week that was and look ahead a week. But yes, it's crazy how the NBA schedule works, and you know, that Monday in Minneapolis and sitting in a McDonald's, it seems like it was about a month ago, and it was just 1 week ago, and so much has happened and transpired since then. But I guess I'll make my plea that I did to start that show. My Twitter account was not filled with mentions and pleas to come do the podcast at locations around Central Indiana. So we're back in an audio booth in Bankers Life Fieldhouse right now. We're not even in the new building.
No, we're in a tiny little. This would be hilarious if you guys saw where you're coming from, because we are in a like 8x10 room with padding.
I'm glad Pat wore deodorant today.
Yeah, let's just put it that way. You know, it's really interesting. We're 6 games into the season. We've seen a little bit of everything, and yet 3 of the games have had this excitement level, this kind of energy that I think we were missing a lot last season. And you know, we don't know where the season's going to go so far, but I find the first 6 games pretty fascinating, because there's been a lot, I think, of what was only a little last year, the energy, the fight kind of thing, the never down kind of thing. And that was perfectly exemplified by last night. Watching that game, third quarter, they're holding this lead, and I kept thinking in the back of my head, what happens when San Antonio goes on that run? Because they're probably going to go on that run. And it was even bigger than I thought it was going to be. It was 9-0 to open the quarter. It kind of felt like, okay, that was their statement. These are the Spurs. This is what they do. And the Pacers don't have, you know, that elite superstar level player, at least yet. How are they going to combat it? And they did combat it. They went on their own version of a 9-0 run, down 85-80, and took the lead in the fourth. And we know how it ended with Vic's fantastic shot. He and Domantas Sabonis were the major highlights of a big win last night. But I guess unlike those first 2 wins where the Pacers just blitzed the other teams with points, they won a game where neither hit 100.
Before the game, Nate McMillan told me that it would be one of those games where whoever could play the game at the pace they wanted would probably win. And actually that didn't happen, because if you said before the game neither team hits 100, it's a Spurs kind of game. And the way that third quarter was going, I just found myself thinking this game is going to be a golden opportunity that this team is probably going to let slip away, because the Spurs were struggling so much offensively, and the Pacers had a chance, kind of like they did in Minneapolis and taking on the Timberwolves, where they took that lead and grew it to double digits and really put the Timberwolves away. I thought in the third quarter, the Pacers had a chance to really blow that game open. And if you get ahead of the Spurs by 15, they've got a game Monday night against Boston that maybe they call it in early. And they just could never do that. And the third quarter was tough to watch. The Spurs outscored the Pacers 16-15. The shooting percentages in that quarter were horrendous. And so, yeah, when the Spurs got the lead and they were up 9 in the fourth quarter, you had to just kind of think, because you've seen this team for so many years, that's not the kind of situation that benefits them. And they just dug down deep, and Victor Oladipo just would not let them lose. And I mean, there was a couple of 3-pointers that he hit. I mean, obviously the last one, but before that, from down 5 to down 2 with about 6 minutes to play, and then attacking the basket with the and one. I mean, you have to like what he's doing in the box score, but everything else that he's doing to just get these guys to believe. And I'm watching some things in timeouts and the way he's talking to players in a positive manner. Wow, a great fight. And, you know, it's been fun to listen to the radio and hearing some of the talk show hosts and the fans calling in and the Twitter mentions I'm getting. I mean, how much people are enjoying the first 6 games is probably the best 3-3 start I think anyone could ever imagine.
Yeah, I think you're right, because it's an entertaining brand of basketball. They've been fun to watch. And for me, the recipe to winning has become very clear. Domantas Sabonis just has to hit every single shot he takes. It's 23 of 23 in the three wins this year. And, you know, it's funny because that game is it's down to the wire, and he had that, like, right wing jumper from about 16 feet. And it was a good look. It was a good shot with a guy that can knock it down. And there was part of me in my head going,
I was the exact same way. You're going to ruin your perfect shooting.
And he knocked it down.
If he doesn't hit it, they don't win.
I know. It was amazing. And as we found out, which to give you kind of a little insight and pull back the curtain a little bit to how some of the TV and the radio broadcasts work, after games win, and we've talked about this before, but after the Pacers win, we each do a walk-off interview. You for television, me for radio. You get the first pick, and then I get the second pick. And so, you know, originally, as that game was winding down, I was assuming you were going to pick Domantas because he was having the big game. It was before the Oladipo late heroics. And I kind of, after Vic hit that shot, I had started to prepare questions for Vic, and I thought, I bet he's going to take Vic now. So I kind of stood up and made eye contact with you across the arena and said, you going to take Vic? And you said yes. And so after the post game, I obviously took Domantas. I feel those were the clear one and one A's. And it's funny because we were talking to as we do these interviews off the floor right after the game, they're often pretty different from in the locker room because the guys are still such heated and they're still in the moment and they haven't had time to cool down. And I did not catch what Vic told you, which was that Domas was actually sick. And I think just all the adrenaline he had going in him, I couldn't hear that in our radio walk-off interview, and you came up to me afterwards and said, hey, Victor said that Domas was sick, and then we went into the locker room. I went into the locker room after and started talking to him, and immediately you could hear his voice was really hoarse, and he was raspy, and he was kind of sniffling, and he had you know, one of the doctors in there talking with him about how to best care for that. He was 9 for 9. He had a career high in points. He matched his career high in rebounds, and he did it while significantly under the weather.
And it was interesting. We interviewed Domas at halftime because he was sort of the star of the first half, or one of the players that was worth talking to. And when the Pacers have the lead or are tied, we get that halftime interview. And to be honest with you, it'd be fun to go back to the FS Indiana Twitter account and listen to the two interviews. I thought he sounded relatively normal at that halftime interview. He wasn't a long interview, and Domas is still, you know, he's not a long-winded answer type of guy anyways. But if you listen to that, it sounded fine. So I did not even have any idea either that he was not feeling well. Sometimes before a game, I'll walk in the locker room and just get the lay of the land a little bit. I did not do that last night. So I really had no idea, no shoot around with an afternoon game that Domas was not feeling well. And Victor kind of threw it out there. It wasn't a specific question about Sabonis, even though that was one of the areas or one of the angles I was going to go, but then so many other things happened in the final minute of the game and then after the game as well. When I saw him hand the game ball to GR3, I thought that was pretty interesting. And then This Is My City was one that you could not you had to ask. So I did not ask about Sabonis. He said he's sick. I hope he stays sick, you know. And then you interviewed him as well, and you know, he sounded awful. I mean, like, to be honest, I don't know, later today he should get the day off from practice, honestly, and just ice that arm a little bit so he can kind of keep that perfect percentage going. But you know, if you're watching on television, it was one of the best, also most frustrating kind of minutes of live television, because I had just done a in-game hit reporting on what was being discussed in the final huddle. Microphone worked fine, not something that I would change or do anything different, but then got ready to do the interview with Victor, and apparently the batteries on the wireless microphone had died. So right when Chris and Quinn threw it to me, I'm standing there with Victor, I'm trying to talk, and producers are in my ear saying, turn the mic on, and I wanted to be like, I've not done this, this isn't my first time, I know the microphone's on, but I kept flipping the switch off and on and off and on, and it was a helpless feeling because I knew it wasn't coming on. And then luckily, Max Linewan and Jamie Burns, they were able to quickly get to a replay of the highlight, and Chris and Quinn started talking, and I know there's a backup hardwire mic really close by, so I was able to go get that, yank that off the table, and Victor was still kind of standing there relishing the moment a little bit, and he did not care to wait an extra minute or so. But then we eventually got the interview and learned a few things from Victor that I thought people really enjoyed hearing as well, and it was a good start to the post-game show. But what a game, and you know, just a fun afternoon at the Fieldhouse.
I was in the locker room waiting to get into the locker room, actually, and was kind of thinking about the night and Victor's shot and trying to put it all into context and coming up with at least an attempt at semi-intelligent questions. And, you know, I started having the thought, and you travel, and so while I work the road games from our studio, you're there and can capture the environment of road games better than I can. I started to wonder, because you and I have been in these on-air positions now with the Pacers for four seasons, so we essentially started these jobs at the same time. You've been here for five, but with this role for four. And I started thinking, you know, if you just take our time here, which kind of coincided with the end of that Eastern Conference Finals run and what was the Paul George broken leg on era, I started thinking that that was the biggest shot, Victor, that I've seen hit in my early into fourth season. And so I posed the question on Twitter and had a lot of people saying, you know, remember the Solomon Hill put back from the Stuckey shot. Thad Young had a good one last year. Glenn Robinson the third in Atlanta. That's probably the closest competition would be that GR3 shot, which literally happened at the buzzer. Vic's didn't happen at the buzzer, but Vic had a higher degree of difficulty. But it's interesting because Victor has played here for six games, and he might have the clutchest shot of 4 years.
Yeah, and he really had a couple. I mean, you think about driving in with the and one before that. I mean, just he shows he wants the ball. He's confident he's going to knock down that shot. The Solomon Hill play was remarkable, but it just is an effort play. It's not necessarily an inordinate amount of skill right. involved. I think the one that would stand out, and maybe a little bit recency bias, would have been the GR3-3 because you're on the road and there was no timeouts, and it required great teamwork. And so I think sometimes in the moment, people say, oh, you know, that team last year would have never done this. They never would have done that. And you hit that shot, and it just changes everything. So, you know, to be fair, that was a great late game situation. That was great teamwork. It was improvising a little bit, that game in Atlanta. And, you know, with Glenn hitting that shot, he's someone that we'd all had been waiting to kind of, you know, we're still hoping that he can kind of break out, and he had a good season last year, but you just felt really good for Glenn. So that's probably the one shot that stands out to me from what you said about a late game or a clutch situation. But it's just it's interesting. In six games, you cannot help. We're so close to it, and it's going to be, I think, it's going to start to spread nationally just a little bit, the whole trade situation, because you can't help but compare to previous teams and the previous star players or player and the players the Pacers got from the Thunder. And, you know, Paul George, it was well documented. Now, some of those stats that he was 0 for 15 or 16, they were on with a certain amount of time on the clock in certain situations. Right. So even the storyline today is not, I don't think, incredibly fair to Paul, because we did see him
Agreed.
Hit some shots.
Agreed.
And he helped this team. I mean, it's really easy right now to forget about some of the things that he did. So we're not here to trash him, but I think as you spin it forward, you've got to love having Victor as a guy with the ball in his hands late. You know he can do it, and you know he'll do it again.
Yeah, but I think if the narrative is trying to become that Paul George was not clutch here, I think that's unfair. Obviously, he never hit that one specific, I think it's under 5 seconds to take the lead or something scenario. But Paul hit some big shots. I mean, even last year, you look at the Utah game against Gordon Hayward, the Lakers game early in the year where they looked doomed and he brought him back. But it is true that what Victor, I believe it's true that what, you know, Victor was able to do last night, we've rarely seen that. And I think, you know, that speaks very highly to Victor. And you mentioned the trade. What's interesting to me about that is both Victor and Domas have brought that up on their own once that I've heard this season. It's such a natural question. Oh, you were, you know, are you?
And we'll get it on the road repeatedly now. I mean, now that this team's getting some attention, yeah.
They brought it up, though. Victor brought it up in the opening night saying, you know, all we heard about last year was Paul George trade for two guys or whatever, and during the offseason. And we had a web show with Domas, which was one of the better ones, one of the better interviews I've ever had, which is interesting because I wasn't expecting that because he's pretty quiet. But what he said was, I thought, really interesting. And he kind of made the point. He goes, you know, I'm not just the throw-in player in the Paul George Victor Oladipo deal. And that really helped me because I knew then that was the perfect situation to ask him that question in the locker room, because he and Victor had the two best games. And I asked him, and he had I think maybe even more interesting quote on TV, you know, where he said something along those lines about how we're not throwing players in the Paul George deal. You know, we want to be here, and we feel that we're more than enough to contribute. And I think they're showing that. Victor's showing that. And so many times it's so natural to think of trades as just like unhuman pieces. They're just moving parts. And think about those guys. They've spent the whole offseason hearing about how the Pacers, you know, got a bad end of a deal with one guy. And it's like, well, hold on. If you're Victor, you're saying, I'm the second pick in the draft, and I've had a pretty decent NBA career so far. And if you're Domas, you were a lottery pick, and you've only had 1 year. And in that year, you started 66 games for a team that made the playoffs. So I think you're sort of sensing that a little bit. These aren't, you know, guys that are going to go beating their chests, but they hear it, and they probably hear it. You know, a lot of those guys, they don't respond to people on Twitter and stuff like that, but you know they see some of that stuff in their mentions. And I think this has been a cool moment. I'm not talking judging the trade, whether the trade, you know, that'll take some time down the line to see. But to see those guys excel here early after the offseason they've had to endure, I'm happy for them.
From a Pacers perspective, it's probably good that was the reaction to the trade, because you could tell one of the themes of training camp was a team full of guys with, quote, something to prove, unquote. And you heard Nate McMillan reference it even at the golf outing before training camp had even started. And you could tell he wanted to try to get those guys thinking, you know, playing like you have something to prove. And you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts and read articles, especially in the off season when you're just, you know, looking for NBA content, and there were no shortage of storylines and things to listen to in the off season. But one of the things that I found interesting was, say what you want about the trade, there was not one person that I listened to, and a lot of people that I respect, and this doesn't maybe change my respect for them, but I found it interesting that everyone had the same thought. No one could, you know, have a differing opinion on the trade. It was pretty much the Pacers were, whether it was because Paul George demanded the trade or for whatever reason, that the Pacers got the short end of the stick. Kevin Pritchard could have gotten so much more. What was he doing thinking about getting Victor Oladipo and Domas Sabonis? And I'm looking forward to seeing some people just at least admit the trade still may be good for OKC, considering, right, to me, when you get Russell Westbrook to sign his contract extension, and if Paul George being on the team this year had anything to do with that, then it was worth it, because that was the main thing they had to do, was make Russell Westbrook happy. But I just look forward to seeing eventually some people say, you know, Victor's pretty good. He's having an all-star season, and I can't think of too many 21-year-old four or five men that I'd like to have, and now the Pacers have two of them with Miles Turner and Domas Sabonis.
Everyone wants to be a trade to be the winner is a 10 and the loser is a 0, but it's very possible for trades to be like the winner is an 8 and the other team is an 8. And yeah, if you're Oklahoma City, I mean, think about it. You lost Kevin Durant. Why would you not make that move if you're Oklahoma City? Sure, it's a risk. Sure, you gave up young, talented players, but they've got Russell Westbrook, and they have to do everything in their power to not lose Russell Westbrook the way they did Kevin Durant. It's a risk you have to take. I am absolutely making that move if I'm Oklahoma City. But if the Pacers are going to lose Paul George anyway, and they get a player like Victor Oladipo is playing around, an all-star caliber player, and they get Domas Sabonis at age 21, who is looking well mature beyond his years from an on-the-court and off-the-court standpoint, then that's a huge win for the Pacers as well. That's not losing Durant for nothing. That's getting two really good pieces back for him. And everyone wants to be a winner and a loser in the trade, but that doesn't have to happen in a trade. And the whole reason trades happen is because one team thinks it helps them more than status quo, and another team thinks it helps them more than status quo. So by definition, if both GMs do their job correctly, both teams do win a trade. And I think we'll see what happens with Paul George. If they lose Paul George in the offseason, it's going to be a tough move for Oklahoma City, but I still contest it's a move in their scenario that you have to make. And it's possible for both teams to end up on the right side.
And I promise we will not talk about this trade all season long, but the players will have to talk about it, because yeah, it is a big topic from the summer and now carrying into the start of the season. But just one final thought on that. For everyone that was just so enamored with getting a future draft pick, you're a fan, likely, if you're listening to this podcast. How much more fun are you having right now with Victor Oladipo and Domas Sabonis and projecting out to the next, not just now, but projecting what they can do for the next 2 or 3 years and beyond, compared to, even if the most unlikely scenario, but if you could have gotten the quote-unquote the Brooklyn pick from Boston, everyone would have thought that would have been a spectacular thing. Well, you know, Brooklyn doesn't look that bad. That pick might be about the 7th or 8th pick in next year's draft or next June's draft. And so then you compare who that person could be who could be an 18 or 19-year-old kid with 1 year of college who then needs another 2 or 3 years to develop. And right now you've got someone who's basically in his prime, playing with a chip on his shoulder and playing like an all-star, hitting game-winning shots, embracing Indiana. He wants to be here. I mean, every day it's just like I almost thought I should go shake Kevin Pritchard's hand after we do this podcast, but it's a long season and you don't want to jinx it and that kind of thing. But you just have to enjoy what you're watching right now.
Bottom line, wouldn't you want, even if you got that pick and it was 7 or 8, wouldn't you want him looking like Domantas Sabonis is looking right now anyway? So, yeah, hard to argue. And by doing it this way, they didn't have to wait 2 or 3 years down the line. This process could happen quicker. Let's look into our pick three now. And we're 6 games in, 3 wins, 3 losses. The 3 wins have all, for different reasons, been – you know, really captivating. So we decided we want to look at our top 3 plays of the 6 games so far. There have been a lot of them. I think if you follow this podcast, you pick one, I pick one, there's a joint pick. I think the joint pick is about as obvious as any joint pick is ever going to be. But your personal pick is?
My pick would be from the game that until Sunday, and I would say even including the win against the Spurs, that win at the Target Center against the Timberwolves was one of the most enjoyable games to watch that I can remember in quite some time, and just the way they did it. And so I'm going to pick one play from that game, and it was really from that stretch from the middle of the third quarter until the end of the third quarter, and it was the last play. It was Darren Collison hitting a 3-pointer just before the buzzer, and it gave the Pacers a 14-point lead. And what's remarkable about that to me is that the Timberwolves were up 5, and it just had the feeling of one of these games that, as you're watching, you know, Minnesota's eventually going to figure it out. Now, they were playing without Jimmy Butler, and now the Pacers were playing without Miles Turner as well, but the Pacers go on a little bit of a run after being down 5, and it was key to me to go up by like 14. If you're up 8, if you're up 10, it's easy to make a run at home and to get back into the game. But when the Pacers went up 14 at the end of the third quarter, and they did it with, you know, guys like Al Jefferson, Darren Collison, Victor Oladipo, obviously, but Darren Collison is someone that hits that 3, has a big night, and someone that I think we probably need to talk a little bit more about, because his first game not in double figures was Sunday against the Spurs, but he had 6 assists, and he has one of the best assist-to-turnover ratios in the entire NBA. And so Darren Collison, he got the post-game walk-off interview in that game as well, and the first 2 games that the Pacers won were Darren Collison interview games. So I thought that 3 at the end of the third quarter, when you can go on that run and look up and say, wow, you're going to start the fourth quarter with a 14-point lead on the road. I think 98-84 was the score at the end of the third, and you almost have 100 through 3 quarters. You're doing something right, so that stands out to me as mine.
Yeah, and this was before last night's game. He didn't score quite as many points as he has in others, but at least heading into last night's game in the early part of the season, the only player in the NBA averaging 15 points, 8 assists, and doing all that with 2 turnovers or less per game was Darren Collison. And a quick hat tip to Basketball Reference to go back to that Minnesota game. I don't get to thank them enough, but they are so pivotal in these games where records are on the line and all of this is happening so quickly. And the Pacers shot a franchise record 67% in that game in Minnesota. And I was furiously, I felt like a much less intelligent version of like whatever those guys at NASA do, because I was sitting at the computer and feverishly punching things into this big spreadsheet that they have and punching out these queries and trying to get information, because they actually typically when you're in position like that to break a franchise record, but you're up by a lot, if you're shooting 65%, you're going to miss a couple shots. The backups come in, Joe Young or Anabogu miss a couple shots, and you lose.
Joe hit one that night.
Joe hit him. Everyone was hitting him, and you lose that. So I was looking all that up, but still not that optimistic. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're going to do this. They're going to break that record. They shot 77% in the second half, which is just unfathomable how you could shoot almost 80. I mean, think about that. If you shoot 77% from the foul line unguarded in a game, that's good. And they did that in one night. So hat tip to Basketball Reference. My pick's actually an interesting
one. Hat tip to you for doing that on Basketball Reference and then texting us during the game so we could
that's,
get that.
That's one area where being not on site actually does help, because you don't have, you know, a computer in front of you, and there's things that I can do quicker actually on road games that I'm not able to do quite as quickly at home games. And so that does help. That can look up those kind of things and tweet them out or text them out to you guys and try to help those of you on site. My pick, I think, is going to be one that people aren't necessarily thinking about because this player has only played one game. That's, of course, Miles Turner. But as last season progressed, I kind of sensed this confidence change in his play around the basket on offense. I think he's been really confident on defense. But, you know, a lot of times we see Miles drive the lane, then he kind of has that midair collision with the guy who's trying to go straight up, and then he kind of, like, tries to flip it off the backboard. And he had that dunk against Cleveland where he went, I can't remember who he dunked over, but he kind of caught the ball off an offensive rebound on the wing, and he dunked it over him. And that almost made me wonder if that was a light bulb moment for him. And in that Nets game in the opener, he had a moment where off a miss, he caught the ball top of the key and just darted down the lane and dunked it with the ferocity that we hadn't seen a ton out of him. You know, and he's trying to balance, you know, he's in some ways a little bit of a finesse player because he's a really good shooter and he's athletic, but also having that around the basket skill. And I thought that, and this is obviously tough to tell, and you can't tell it in just one play, and when he's hurt, that doesn't help either. But I was kind of hoping that that is the version of him we'd see. That lane's open, and he can go down there and do stuff like that. And I thought that was a really promising sign. I know everybody's wondering about his condition, and we don't really know. He is in the protocol. I believe he's in step one of the protocol or early in the protocol. We don't exactly know that. But unfortunately, this has taken longer than I know anybody would like. But hopefully that he's starting to go down the path to recovery. But regardless, his path to that dunk on opening night, I hope, is telling for the player that we'll see the rest of the year once he's healthy.
Great choice for number two in the pick three. And we will conclude the pick three, and a good week to have the pick three with Breeders' Cup coming up. Hope everyone hits some pick threes at Del Mar this weekend. But the pick three, the final leg, will be the Victor Oladipo shot. And you know, watching it live, it did not strike me that it was as high arcing of a shot as it was, you know, especially in a situation like that. From my vantage point, sometimes I'm even watching the big screen more than I am actually the game on the court, because that is a real time shot, but I have a clear view of the big screen and I don't have a clear view of the court, because not only are the entire bench is standing up, but then there are also people walking in front of me, and it's just almost impossible to see. And I don't want to move and walk and get in someone else's way. So I'm often watching the big screen. And what I did for that one was I was watching up top the scoreboard, and then I could see the basket. So I kind of went from up to just looking at the basket, and I saw it go in. So it didn't really strike me, other than he was doing against LaMarcus Aldridge, and maybe in that switch you'd hope he would have, I don't know. I don't know what the best situation is. You like it as a mismatch, but you don't want to go in too much. But I thought maybe he could have driven by Aldridge, and maybe that was what Nate McMillan wanted. And he said afterwards, well, we didn't need the three, but I like that he was confident to shoot the three. It all sounds good when it goes in. But that was a clutch shot and a high degree of difficulty shot.
It's funny how those moments kind of go in slow motion sometimes, because I saw him take it, and I couldn't believe he took it. And then as the shot's going in the air, I got blocked by either a ref or McMillan standing in front of us. So I'm kind of watching it, and then I lose it, and then I'm like, kind of did one of these. And it's interesting because you guys had him on the TV broadcast, but Glenn's now sitting next to us as David Benner's PR intern, like Paul did a couple of years ago. But it's to me fascinating to watch how a player watches the game, and Glenn is so into it. He's talking to all the players as they come by to check in, but he's, you know, calling out ball screens,
really,
and not really even to anybody necessarily, yeah. But just kind of like thinking it through in his head. And you know, he's you could see him maybe one day wanting to be a coach just from those couple of moments. But as that shot was in the air, I kind of like had to lean over, and I ended up being, because David Benner had gotten up, I was almost like right next to Glenn. And so it was kind of funny being next to him and watching the ball go in and Glenn celebrate and all of that. But no, obviously a huge shot. And then what was funny is after Boyle called it, Boyle came down to me in the aftermath and said, you know, Pat, you've got a better view at us. That looked like a extremely difficult shot did it to you. And so I said, yeah, you know, you could argue it was an ill-advised shot, but when it goes in, it doesn't matter. And then Slick kind of took it, and he goes, that's right, baby, when it goes in, it doesn't matter if the shot or whatever, which got to love those Slick moments. But yeah, I think a moment at the end of the year that's going to fall into our top couple of plays, regardless of how the season turns out.
Yeah, great to have one of those in front of the home fans against a team that is widely, you know, thought of as one of the top teams in the entire NBA. It was coming off a loss, and I guess we'll spin this forward a little bit to the next game, the next two games. But I'm not going to look past the Kings, and the Pacers cannot look past the Kings, but the Spurs were coming off a loss. They were likely disappointed by the way they played against the Magic. And while the Pacers were rested, it does say something to me that last year the Spurs only lost three times back-to-back games. And they're a team that usually responds to playing poorly and having a loss. And so the Pacers got that win. And now Wednesday, the Cavs lost at home to the Knicks last night. And now they don't have a game Monday or Tuesday, and they're home on Wednesday against the Pacers. Meanwhile, the Pacers will have to play on the second half of the back-to-back again. This will be the third time this season they will be on the road in the second half of a back-to-back against a team that's coming off either an embarrassing or a just disappointing loss. It happened with the Miami Heat, who had lost to Orlando in the season opener, and they had a bunch of rest. Then it happened against the Oklahoma City Thunder. They had 2 days off after a buzzer-beating loss to the Timberwolves. And now it'll happen against the Cavs, and, you know, there'll be 3 days' worth of stories about what's wrong with the Cavs. And so it's a tough situation coming up on Wednesday for the Pacers. But before that, you just got to take care of business against the Kings on Tuesday.
And that's the key, I think, to this season for the Pacers is – Sacramento's coming in. Sacramento's 1-5, I think. You know, this is a team that the Pacers are at home. They're probably more talented than and should win. But the Pacers this year aren't in a scenario where they can have an off night, but their superior talent and being at home can carry them to wins. And while I think the Pacers are going to win some games this year where they out-hustle teams and they out-energy teams and they win games at the end because of, you know, the level of energy and when healthy, how much depth the Pacers have, I think they have to be careful of the opposite, which is being at home and playing against, you know, one of the lower teams in the NBA. But the Pacers aren't, you know, they aren't Golden State. They aren't one of, you know, the teams that Golden State has plenty of off nights and they still win games. The Pacers have to be focused in each and every night. And if they have three or four players that don't play well, they're going to struggle regardless of the opponent. So I think teams like Sacramento coming in all year long are going to be a focus on, you know, the Pacers, I think, have played really good in this underdog role of, you know, these guys lost Paul George and who are they kind of thing. It'll be interesting to me to see how on the flip side of that, when they come in and Sacramento visits and the Pacers are favored and people think that Indiana should take care of this game, how they respond, because that's a whole different challenge mentally.
It remains to be seen what will happen because they haven't really been in one of these situations yet this season where they go into a game as a prohibitive favorite, where it's a game, oh yeah, they for sure should win. I mean, obviously the season opener, but you can't really know what a team is or should be in the season opener. And the Nets played well, you know, they played better than anyone expected in that first game, and I think they've lost a couple recently, but they're still, that game doesn't count in, under this circumstance. So this will be the first time the Pacers will face one of those situations where everyone is expecting them to win. Just based on the makeup of the roster and the way this team plays, you don't know they're going to hit all their shots. You know, they're not going to shoot 50% every game. They're going to have some defensive lapses. But I just think by the makeup of this team, they're going to be one that takes advantage of most of those opportunities where they've got a team coming in that they should beat. They're on the home floor. They should win. We'll see what happens Tuesday. I mean, the Kings had an embarrassing loss at home against the Wizards on Sunday night. So George Hill didn't even play in that game. It'll be interesting to see if he plays, and if he does, we'll no doubt have a little extra motivation here against the Pacers. But I think this is a team that will not be satisfied with getting that win against the Spurs, and they'll come out and they'll play hard. Interesting dynamic being Halloween. It's always tough from a crowd perspective. People are trick-or-treating. Is it going to be a big crowd? I don't know. But if you are in attendance, you need to be loud. Provide that six-man support the team needs.
And obviously, when you've got kids, trick-or-treating takes precedence over Pacers games, and we understand that. But if you are considering and, you know, you're kind of on the fence, there are going to be plenty of Halloween-themed things going on around the arena, including a little bit of a pseudo trick-or-treat kind of thing. So if you're considering it, but, you know, don't want to miss out on the Halloween experience altogether, you're going to get some of that at the Fieldhouse. And we understand, you know, nothing replicates being at 6, 7. You've got a couple of these kids that age and trick-or-treating. But it is going to have a Halloween kind of theme. And I think if you're looking for that and Pacers basketball, you're going to really enjoy this game coming up on Tuesday night. And again, Pacers.com/tickets or the box office is how you can do that. But I don't think you're going to be disappointed if you're considering coming to that game. You're kind of on the fence. Our game ops crew's fantastic. We talked with Dean Heveland last week on this podcast. They're going all out for this game. I think the fans who come are really going to like it. And then, as you mentioned, that back-to-back against Cleveland will not be easy.
And so 3-3 through six games has been a difficult schedule. And projecting over the next 2 weeks, maybe record-wise, you'll have a few opponents in there that you're confident against. But it's a road-heavy next couple of weeks. So you've got that opportunity Tuesday to see the Pacers against the Kings, then another three-game road trip. And then you're home for one, and then you hit the road again for two more. So it's a challenging start to the season. It's been made more difficult by Miles Turner being out of the lineup since the opening night. So to have these three wins through six games, I think, is a very good start for this team and really something to build on moving forward. I'm having a great time, Pat. I think you are as well. We hope that you're enjoying the podcast as well. We'll try to be pretty regular, maybe Monday or Tuesday, or get them to be an early week situation. The NBA has gone 2 weeks in the season now, so this is the start of the third week. So I think it is good to do it in the beginning of the week, but 2 weeks in, and I'd say so far so good.
And after you've done one in a McDonald's, really you can do one anywhere, I think.
Yeah, it was a great time.
He's Jeremiah Johnson. I'm Pat Boylan. We'll talk to you next week on the Sideline Guys podcast.